Happy Father's Day, by the way.
That's a mean thing. That's
well, you know how you like to bring up your daddy issues in every episode.
Don't laugh. We don't need to see the malevolent side of.
Magnus the Malevolent.
This is James McLean. That is.
Magnus.
Yes, that is Magnus. This is a highly compressed time event because we've got several episodes, haven't we?
Five.
And you have just digested Boom.
Boom, 73 Yards, Dot and Bubble, Rogue, and The Legend of Ruby Sunday.
So that's five. And I think, to be fair, given we're running late, if you listen to podcasts or if you use social media, which is predominantly most people, you'll probably have read a lot of stuff around this. So us doing belated long podcasts per episode is probably a bit of a waste of time at this moment. But this is kind of a...
You just got to take it or leave it.
Yeah, I like that.
I was either going to watch none of them or all of them immediately on one day and then record the podcast the next day.
So
no middle ground.
So what you're saying is that the pigeon, the pigeon can decide whether they sit and listen and accept the conditions that we offer, or it...
Well, they can find them elsewhere on any of your social medias.
Absolutely. Or do whatever pigeons do. Let's jump into it. Do you want to sort of like give a sort of overall feeling? Because you've just digested five episodes.
Well, so I am suffering from recency bias. So I'm thinking about the last one I watched, The Legend of Ruby Sunday, the most because I've just watched it. But yeah, I watched Boom and 73 Yards sort of together and then the other three together.
Well, then let's do it consecutively and build towards the most recent one.
I liked Boom. I thought it was interesting that they used the Anglicans as the religious pioneering, I guess, colonizers, I assume. I was intrigued by the ambulance and the AI warfare. Yeah, I thought it was good. I mean, there's definitely a theme of AI and the dangers of AI and automated weapons systems and the threat of technology.
Ourselves.
And capitalism.
I was going to say, the marrying of capitalism to technology. Because this one was written by Stephen Moffat, in previous stories he's had interest in like church-like structures. If you remember, the Silence were in the end part of a church-like organization. So he's always had a bit of an interest in sort of the militarization of ideologies. Anglican is actually, as you say, quite specific.
I wonder because it's got less that kind of attachment by Catholicism and other faiths might perhaps have more bad history, which doesn't mean that the Anglicans don't, but I guess currently in popular culture, Anglicans are quite like, hello, would you like a spot of tea with the vicar? DNK.
Particularly British.
Yeah, I think that's what I was kind of thinking about. It's a very...
Tea.
Yeah.
Cake. God.
Tea, cake, colonizing.
I suppose it's also the idea that, and it's not a new one, it's been done many, many times before, but this whole idea that war is inherently always ideological in some form or another, and to some degree a war is fought on the faith of what you're doing is right. For as a soldier, you have a chain of command, a chain of authority leading up, and you do your part. You are a soldier to a cause. And I suppose that linking of that direct links to soldiers and ideology, which some people would say, yeah, you can see that with the Crusades, but I think that's very much where that dovetail, which I think Moffat finds quite interesting. In both cases, you need to have faith. And I suppose we don't tend to think of faith so much as in military. We think of the science and the technology and the organization, but ultimately as a soldier, you've got to have faith that the mission you have been given is a righteous one.
Yeah. So, it does seem kind of ludicrous that they never saw any enemy at all that continued fighting.
Yeah. I mean, I found when I watched it, I found the whole space interesting. And then when he trod on the mine, and very quickly, I kind of, like most of us did, worked out this is going to be a whole episode with him standing on a mine. It's a fun idea, but ultimately to watch, I was kind of disappointed because I knew we would probably not see much further than that crater, that was going to be it.
But I guess if it's in a war zone, then everything is crater.
True.
For many miles.
True.
I really enjoyed that the dad who became like a cremated fleshy canister turned itself into an AI killing virus. That was well done.
Because I really liked the dad in the opener, and I was kind of
disappointed. Yeah, I was disappointed that he was killed off.
Yeah. So did you see as you're obviously now aware with the Susan Triad, Susan Twist, I mean, they obviously start making it more obvious after Boom that there is this face that is replicating.
Yeah, I did. I guess because it's a central character, I noticed it. I thought it was interesting when they're talking about injuries and how the AI is on the fritz. So, like, the acceptable losses become like, you're suffering from blindness. Now to terminate you.
It felt very much within that whole Doctor Who scope of... Did you feel it felt different in tone, given you've got a different writer for that one? Did it feel to you, or did it feel very much in the same space? Because I think this is something that's always interesting, because you see it a lot now in social media discourse, that people pick out different tones of different episodes or seasons based on what they know. But like when I watched Community for the first time and I watched season 4, I had no idea that Dan Harmon had left or had been fired. And to me, it just felt like Community. But if you read all the discourse, all the fans were very much like, we can tell that Dan Harmon's no longer there. And I always wonder how much you really can tell in these cases and how much it's because you know that you start putting the pieces together.
Yes, the only way to prove that would be to do double blind studies.
But you do. I mean, but you kind of did, because did you notice it was by Moffat? Did you see that on the opening credits?
No.
Did you feel that this was written by someone? Did it feel different to...
I mean, it's a definite key change from The Devil's Chord, pardon the pun.
Very nice.
And the only thing that stuck out to me was the female character, the priest soldier, vicar soldier or whatever. And her, like the romance B plot, like her dialogue is just a bit... It's so clunky. It felt clunky and kind of, it felt like a waste.
Yeah.
So that's what I noticed.
Because Moffat's very much a...
Heterosexual.
Heterosexual, right, yes. I wasn't going there so quickly as you, but yes. Small things which are very much part of the heterosexual male writer trope, which is the woman is unaware of the male interest.
Yeah.
That to me is always a very male writer trope.
She just doesn't know how pretty she is. And that's what makes her a good female love interest.
And because the male is really obvious as well, so the audience is aware, but the female is oblivious. And it's like, nah, that's not going to happen. If it was very subtle, maybe, but like that, nah, she'd have picked up on that. That's, you know, not blind. And that's very much the same. I pull that more with, say, a Moffat story than I would a Davis story. But yeah, I mean, I liked it. It was nicely done. Like I said, I felt that as well. There was little bits of that romance which felt a little by the numbers and not very organic and true to how people.
Also, then he just dies.
Yeah.
So yeah. It's very much the feels like a very obvious plot device.
I know you don't like doing this, but Christian likes it. If you were to sort of give it, and I know your kind of ratings, I know how you like to rate in
that. I would give it 4 space butterflies.
4 space butterflies. Right, well, bear that in mind. I suspect your next one is going to be a rating of a different kind, but I am going to ask you to give it a relative comparison. So don't think you're clever by giving it 14 gnome goblets or whatever, because I'm going to ask how that relates back to the space butterflies.
They don't relate back. That's the point.
There's got to be some structure here, Magnus. Otherwise, what's the point of me?
No structure, only chaos.
So moving from boom, 73 yards.
Again, very different to the previous episode.
Which could denote the need for a different rating system.
Hmm. I thought it was going to go in a very different direction to the direction it went in.
So what direction did you think it was going to go into that it didn't?
Well, the synopsis is something like the TARDIS lands in Wales and the villagers are scared of like a local ancient legend. I was like, cool. But it didn't really shake out like that. Yeah. So I guess I kind of wanted from it more ancient Welsh legend.
Mm.
And there's a weird line in it where one of the Welsh characters is like, oh, yeah, that's racist. People just think that we're all druids and into, like, witchcraft. And I was like, I'm sorry. And all the Welsh characters were kind of assholes to this girl who's obviously lost and has, like, nothing with her but her phone, like, in the middle of nowhere. And they're just all dicks to her. So that was hard to take seriously, I guess. But I could take it seriously up until the point where it's like, oh, this is basically like the is it the Slaughtered Lamb in American Werewolf in London?
Yeah, well, I'm not sure if it is, but I know the
you're like and it's
scene
like, oh,
you're
not
about.
From you're not from around here, are you? Type thing, and there's a big like monster that the locals know about, and then the outsider is like, oh, so what's all this about, this weird stuff that's been happening? You can kind of like accept that if that's part of the piece, and then it turned out to be kind of nothing to do with that. You very quickly leave Wales.
Yeah,
so that was kind of weird. I thought Ruby was good in it. I thought she was able to carry an episode really well. And I really liked old Ruby. Old Ruby was great.
I like, as you were saying, the plot structure is interesting. The way it feels like it's going to go to a certain place and it doesn't. But equally, the places you think it's taking to you are kind of based on genres or, like you said, echoes of American Werewolf in London, which, to be fair, doesn't stay in the pub any longer than that opening scene.
But there is a monster.
But that mystery
terrorizing the locals.
Yeah, and again, that sort of leads you into thinking a bit like the synopsis. I didn't realize that you read synopsis. Who reads synopsis?
Well, it's just on under the episode.
That you kind of don't know where that story's going, and I think that's part of the fun of it. Is that it's up until about halfway through where I think you do get a feeling of where the story is going, where you're going, okay, this is really a doctorless episode. This is going to be her going through her life with this entity and adapt and cope with that.
Oh, Ruby, she really went through it.
Because one of the criticisms that episode got, especially online, was the lack of answers. Did that bother you?
Kind of, but mostly because that's the kind of person I am. Not necessarily because it was a bad element of the episode. I did want to know where the doctor was. I wanted it to be explained, like, how the thing worked and why it worked in such and such a way. But I guess one of the themes of that episode was this, they basically stumble into a fairy circle. So if you think of it as her entering an other world where, you know, the laws of the real world don't apply, time passes differently, things aren't what they seem, everything's a bit like, you don't get answers because things don't usually make sense. And then once they go back and make sure that the circle isn't disturbed, everything is reset to the way it should be.
Because I think one of the clever things of doing this is if you're trying to up the threat in Doctor Who, where you've created a character which is virtually a god unto themselves, and you've suddenly got into space where you're going, well, the way we combat this is by introducing gods. You need to get to a point where you don't understand the rules because you are no longer working on a level where the rules are clear. In the same way that I can use a television, suddenly don't really know how they work. And that's really what it's doing. And from what I remember Russell T. Davies saying, I think you're very much right that he broke the circle, but I think it was meant to be her reading the messages, which sort of initiates the curse. And through her life, redeems to a point where it reconfigures, whether that's, as you say, as a different dimension or a different fairy world, or it doesn't really matter.
Yeah, and the figure that haunts her, which is like her older self, definitely reminded me of like the banshee. And like when you hear the banshee scream, it means death. So there are a few elements in there. I think I liked the transition between old Ruby and then Ruby becoming the banshee. That was nicely done. I also liked the joke about like, well, if you want the lights on, just say light. And she's like, I know. We had those when I was a kid. Go off.
There was a lot of rumblings as well that we never found out what she was actually saying to other people.
Yeah, I was wondering, I assume she's just, the words she's actually saying are, don't step in the circle, but I definitely attributed it to like the concept of the banshee, where just by hearing it, you die or go mad. Yeah. I think the most unrealistic thing about the episode was how a Welsh nationalist gets voted in as prime minister. Because that's clearly what he is.
Yeah, I mean, with the words, I always like, again, that sort of lyrical, magical nature of rhetoric, and the idea that it could simply be, like you said, a sort of elemental sort of thing, like with a banshee, or like a curse. Whatever is said doesn't matter. It just makes you do that. Or if it's even more lyrical, like the whole idea that you get in certain fictions of like the five words needed to make someone fall in love with you. It's as if there are certain combinations of words that could be wondrous or terrifying, but we just can't imagine what they are. But you don't need to know. And I think, again, that's the nature of the show, sort of shifting into fairy tale lore, mythology, that sort of side of horror rather than the more monstrified side of horror. And I really like that.
So, I mean, I guess he's not really a Welsh nationalist, but that's definitely how he's coded.
Yeah, no, I definitely think, yeah, he's definitely coded as a Welsh nationalist.
The Albion Party.
What did you feel about, because there's one thing that I saw didn't bother me a little bit, but what I did find was it felt maybe unusually uncomfortable or unusually cruel with I've forgotten her name now. It's the other person that
the victim.
Yeah. Who in the end is kind of inferred that Ruby uses her to get closer, but ultimately is kind of aware of what that actually might curtail by doing that.
Yeah, it does seem, I mean, there's lots of cruelty really in Doctor Who, but yeah, that's an everyday kind of cruelty, isn't it? I guess she doesn't necessarily use her to get closer, but she just doesn't intercede.
Yeah.
Because by interceding, she might not be able to get close to, is it App William? Yeah, it's not her fault, but she doesn't help her.
It did seem cruel, but at the same time, I always wondered whether that was a way of demonstrating that without like a fantastical being like the Doctor, you do end up having, you are not able to save or manipulate events in the same way. And some things you have to accept, you have to work from you, especially in this story where she is utterly isolated from anyone who can help her.
I really, really wanted to know who Mad Jack was. What's his deal? I wanted there to be a monster, and I wanted it to be Mad Jack, but the monster was more nebulous.
Nice word. Do you feel satisfied by the episode?
I felt satisfied once they had completed the cycle, because Ruby basically forgets, doesn't she? Because it never happens. So you as the viewer, I don't know, I found that sense of satisfaction where it's like, it kind of basically never happens.
It's not a total reset button though, is it? Because she does recall having been there at the end. She says several times, three times I think she says. So there is a suggestion that it's not like a total reset. It happened in some form or another, but it no longer has happened.
I've never seen a fairy ring look like that.
I mean, some people are upset because they were like, you know, who leaves a fairy ring?
On the cliffs out of the way where nobody goes. It bothers me that the locals added nothing to the episode. They were just rude and kind of mean. Well, I guess the pub landlady did lend her a jacket.
It's trying to make you feel almost like lost in the story as much as Ruby's lost in the story as well. There's no... She never at one point does she ever think the Doctor's fallen off the edge of the cliff. She assumes it's more likely he's gone and shut himself in that police box and not come out than tumbled down. But
actually, thinking about it, well, skipping to this last episode, my theory is now that Ruby is the child of a god, probably a bad god. So when she dies and basically haunts herself, maybe the act of her being dead is what makes her words so powerful and people lose their shit.
Could be.
Maybe.
Someone didn't note on social media how there's a point in the most recent episode where they say the camera which they had in the past that was surveying the churchyard was 66 meters away, which is metric for the 73 yards.
I like that. That's good. Is that true?
Yeah, it is true.
My metric to yard conversion's not. It's pretty rusty.
Don't worry.
That's clever. I like that.
There are many pigeons out there who are very keen on sorting that out. And
you go, pigeons.
One of the most interesting episodes of the series, Dot Bubble. How did you find that?
I liked it. It was weird. As most Doctor Who episodes are, I thought it was more interesting by the end, where it kind of clearly implies from the beginning, well, when you find out that all the people in that place are the children of the uber, uber rich who have gone there for some reason. And they're all quite vapid and self-centered. And I guess it's kind of takes a lot of aesthetics from influencer culture, quote unquote. But then you think, when you break people out of their routines or out of like the bubbles, the social media bubbles that they're in all the time, people revert to a set norm, which is, you know, it leans on the side of good. We assume that once people are out of those settings, they kind of revert to a base, slightly good angle, especially when you meet, Ricky September? And it turns out he was just a cool guy. Just a cool guy, being cool, tries to save her. And then I was going to call her an NPC, the main side character, Pepper, just completely like stabs him in the back, leaves him to die, doesn't give a shit. And then they all, you think you're getting an ending where they're like, we can be free of this dystopia. We're going to go out and tame the woods. Turns out really not to be that. And they're just assholes. So yeah, that was satisfying in a different way.
Because the first time I watched it, kind of humbling. I didn't notice how white all the background characters.
It's real white. Very, 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 very white. And I think that's emphasized by the sheer overabundance of pastel colors.
But I didn't spot the lack of ethnicity in it. And even at the end, where she sort of says, I couldn't go with you. My brain was like, oh, she just means because they're to them like not rich, non-working, working class, almost like support workers. And, I that's how I saw it. And my family were there and they said, no, I think it's a racist thing there. And I think because you don't get that much pure racism in sci-fi, it's usually coded
I mean, not in 2024.
So I wasn't really expecting it. And then when I rewatched it and I was like, oh yes, not only are they all white, but the way that they talk to the doctor throughout it is extremely dismissive and rude. Mm. Even Ricky September is kind of like, you don't need to tell me this, I know all this anyway. All of them in that culture are very dismissive to him. And yeah, I was like, I felt really bad. I was like, why didn't I spot this? Perhaps it is that for so many decades of just being, I'm still quite used to seeing shows where it is, an entirely predominantly white cast. I've been rewatching Monk recently, and which was 2009, and there are no regular actors of color in that at all. It's all entirely, and that's like 15 years ago, by 2024. So I just didn't really spot it, and I wasn't really looking for the answers. I don't know about you, but when I watch shows, I don't tend to actually try and guess the end. I just follow the flow.
Yeah.
But I did feel like, ooh, is there something systemic there? Maybe I should have spotted that. And like I said, you don't tend to see that sort of blatant racism in sci-fi. As I say, it's always coded. You can see it. It's always there, but it's very rarely. I can't think of any sort of future characters that are going, no, mate, we can't go with you because, you're not like us. But specifically speaking about that sort of
contemporary. Racially and socially.
Yeah, absolutely. And it was brilliantly done.
To the point where he's like, just let me save you. And they're like, no.
No. And his reaction was beautifully done as well. It felt that sort of mixture of anger and sort of
disappointment.
Almost disappointment and yet almost amusement, incredulity at this response, which is just so nonsensical because they are literally going out there to die without realizing it, that was the choice. I think you're right. The ending of the episode is what really makes it.
Yeah. She maintains eye contact for so long.
Yeah. Apparently that was one of his first scenes as well, because he was still doing Sex Education. He was still filming that. 73 Yards was done as well, understandably, unsurprisingly, while he was doing Sex Education and this one as well. So I think this was one of his first scenes, that end scene, to actually come on set. And I believe in what the making documentary, Davis says, how they were a little uncertain about whether that should be the first scene. And they were a bit
hard
nervous
to pull off.
But yeah, it's one of those episodes which, like you said, the payoff is at the end.
Mm.
And the rest of it's, I mean, it's beautifully done all the way through. It looks good and the space feels right. And the characters and the allegory there is really clear.
I think those bug things, I think what the idea is that the dot bubble AI things began to hate them so much that it created something specifically just to kill them. But those things were also on their homeworld, so that suggests that they were using them on the homeworld as well.
Which makes
sense. And they were just consumed.
Because the dot bubble thing seemed like it was very much part of their lives. And while some people have said, well, it's almost like a Love Island space where they all go and just do a little bit of work, but just play all the time. It's very clear that the play is not physical. The play is entirely digital. It's entirely, they're not used to touching, let alone moving without a dot bubble. So yeah, you get the impression that the home world is exactly the same and just as obnoxious, which extends this very Black Mirror like idea that, you know, I'll agree again of our world.
Because the other thing that they said, it was about maintaining, is it prime? Fine time. Which makes sense, because I guess you can't call it prime because Amazon owns everything and everyone.
So moving on from Dot Bubble, we have Rogue.
Rogue was great.
You enjoyed Rogue. Was it your favourite? They are very different.
I enjoyed it for what it was.
What was it then about Rogue that you enjoyed?
It was just fun. And I could see that if they'd written it with a female rogue, it would have been very boring. Because if you think of them being written as a female character, it's just been done so many times.
Yeah.
But yeah, I liked it.
This one did seem to polarise people quite a lot. And I think there might be certain reasons for that, but I think there are. I find romances per episode or bottled to an episode quite difficult because you don't have to feel the natural rhythm of attraction to flirtation to interest. It all has to be compressed and it becomes a little formulaic and a little can't help.
I think it worked in this because you have a sense of the Doctor being very charismatic, quite flirtatious. Like, he's very clear about his interests and his intentions. So that whole episode plays off of that.
Yeah, I liked it. I didn't massively. I'm not a fan of the era. I'm not a fan of the sort of
Regency.
Regency.
I take it you haven't watched Bridgerton.
No.
Yeah. Even like a Regency episode, it's a very specific, like, oh, it's a take on a Bridgerton episode because it's a specific way of like doing a period drama.
And I like the fact they didn't have that sort of guest historical character in there. It was
because they're not doing historical, they're doing Bridgerton.
Yeah, very much so. One of the things that I found didn't work for me in the episode was the ending, so far as there's a point at the end where he realizes that Ruby's caught in the trap. And the suggestion that he suddenly looks and reflects on his role as a guardian, as and promise made. And then that kind of gets lost with Rogue's sacrifice. And that whole movement becomes and it becomes feeling sorry for the Doctor and, you know, oh, you might meet him again sort of thing. And I don't say that still couldn't have been there. But I felt that that was quite an interesting and relevant pivot in the character, which then just pivots away and gets forgotten.
Yeah. But again, that happens a lot in Doctor Who. People get lost or sacrificed.
Which is one of the hardships I find with this persona outside of the next episode we're about to discuss, is that he is a very, very happy, very positive force, and so is Ruby, and justified in the giggle where they sort of say that the 14th Doctor, the Tenant Doctor, is in rehab, and in a sort of timey-wimey temporal way, that means that the 15th Doctor is the result of that rehab and is fresh from away from all the burdens, and
he's got a lot of the same habits as old doctors, which is like don't think about it, don't engage, and just move on, which seems like something that you would tackle in therapy.
And they did this with Tennant and Rose when they first started, that if you make them too happy and excited and the world is just,
you have to kind of also make them a psychopath.
Yes, because what they're having to deal with is they have to deal with, make terrible choices, deal with terrible situations and stuff which isn't pleasant. And yet I kind of feel that you do still need to show that a little. And I think sometimes I felt that's lost a bit. But I think in the following episode, we started to see a little bit of that. And I kind of like that. I know some people would say, oh, it's overly dramatic. Or I don't know. I like to see the characters have to question and think about their actions, because these are dark wars, essentially. They're constantly fighting. And I think the bit of the to and the fro is always nice. And I've always, I felt so far this season's been a lot of the fro and not so much of the to.
I just think in that episode, the dialogue between the Doctor and Rogue was just really well done. Like, it wasn't too much, it wasn't too little, it was clever, it was light, but also insightful. So I just thought it was handled well.
I liked how you very much had a very flirtatious Doctor, and you had a quite walled and cool Rogue, and I think that made for a nice...
I think that's why I liked it. It worked better for me.
And then at the end, Rogue makes this big offering through a sacrifice, which, again, it's done many times before, but was fine. I found it fine. It wasn't my favourite, as I say, just because I think the tone, I think it looked good. It's just an era that just didn't really, really capture me. But I kind of like the idea of the extraterrestrial cosplaying.
It feels very much like something gods would do.
Yeah. I mean, it's what we do when we play various video games, isn't it? You start looking at which character you want to be. Do you want to be the Astarion in Baldur's Gate, or do you want to be a, you know, which one is, and might suddenly go, oh, I'd like to go.
Who's
and
read the coolest? Who's the most interesting?
Exactly. And I want to do that now. Or in D&D, in these sort of roles, these sort of role-playing worlds where you are kind of working together and sort of picking out, you know, what sort of characterizations you'd love to adopt. So I like it. Topical.
Yeah, it was well timed because the second half of the Bridgerton season has just been released.
Yes.
And the first half would have been released not too long before that episode actually aired, which is just really well timed.
So, Legend of Ruby Sunday.
Yeah, that's a fun episode. Scary.
It did feel very much...
It felt very Eccleston era.
Yes, that's what I was going to say.
Didn't it?
Yes, yes.
Yeah, it was good.
The internet is a very different beast now to even back in 2005, 2006. So trying to actually find ways of surprising audiences becomes harder, especially when they get used to your tricks and the tricks of the show.
I liked the God of Death.
Sutek. So Sutek has a legacy in the show. So
oh, yeah.
If you know the show and you are getting a little
Doctor
bit old...
Doctor Who literate.
Or you are Doctor Who literate, whichever you choose to be, or both. Sutek is first pops up in a Tom Baker story called Pyramids of Mars.
Sorry. Makes sense.
There is an argument. It's never been clarified. Do you remember the David Tennant story with the devil, the Satan pit that was...
Oh, yeah.
Was one with the black hole and the devil inside it. There was an argument that that's also Sutek, because the voice of the devil in that is the same person who did the voice of Sutek in the 1975 Pyramids of Mars story.
That feels deliberate.
For a lot of people watching this, especially Doctor Who fans who have been spending the last few weeks trying to suss out where this is going. And what's very clever with this story is that a lot of them sussed out that S triad is TARDIS. I'd seen, as I'd spun through various social media comments, people sort of talking about, is this Susan twist, Susan character, is this a TARDIS? Is it actually the TARDIS?
Oh, and interesting.
So I think it was kind of, again, just showing that smart sort of interplay between understanding your fans and writing to actually weave in these essentially, well, not total red herrings, but stuff which has got enough substance to the story. Yes, you're right, it is TARDIS. But then also early on, acknowledging that everyone in that room, in the unit room, was there going, yeah, we'd all work that out as well. Almost.
No dare.
Yeah, exactly. Kind of sort of saying to fans, yeah, we guessed that you'd work this out, but we all worked it out and we're going to acknowledge it. So you've not won anything there.
You don't understand. We wrote it.
So there's that clever little level. And then for the end level at the very end, to then switch this round and it to be Sutek with Susan and the technology. There's been a few things in this season which you won't have noticed, but some of the pigeons who might be listening to this will have worked out. Like there's that scene in Brain is Going in the Devil's Cord where they go into the future and he shows her the future is desolate and destroyed from based on the is a lift from a scene in Pyramids of Mars, where he takes Sarah Jane into the future to show in the year 1980. So the links to that story have been hinted at. So yes, to see it then come down and then playing off all the gods that he spoke of. Some of those gods have had relevance to previous stories. The Mara is a monster from the Peter Davison era. The toy maker.
Maestro.
Maestro.
Did they mention Maestro?
I think they do. They mention, they don't mention directly, but the gods of Ragnarok, which is three gods, which might be the father, son, and the mother, father, and the other, might be a reference to the Ragnarok, which are gods which McCoy faced as well. So there's a few pepperings of these gods in there. And I remember, I always find this fascinating in writing, is like, when is the point where you can let the audience work out ahead of the statement, the revelation? You can let them work it out, but you have still won. When is that point? When is that line between them winning and sort of guessing it before they should, and you allowing them to get it before you've said it, but it's too late because you've already owned them by that point? You know what I mean? Where's that line?
It's in the episode.
So at the end of that, where he starts...
They have to make the realization in the episode leading up to the reveal.
Exactly. But I mean, there's a line when he's going through the gods at the end that says, Seth, Set... And then my brain was like, it's Sutek. It's going to be Sutek. It's Sutek from Pyramids of Mars, Egyptian god Sutek. But by that point, it's too late. You know, you've not said Sutek, but he's got you at that point. How, it's just interesting to think, like, when can you get it ahead of the writer? And when can you get it ahead of the statement, but you're still behind the writer? Another example was, I've said this before, I think, with Life on Ashes to Ashes, with the clown in the first season of Ashes to Ashes, and the reveal of the clown in that. I remember watching my sister seeing it, and there's a point just before the revelation of who the clown is, and she got it. But it was, I just felt it was too late. They'd got to a point where they were in that zone where they were very happy for you to work it out at that point. They were very happy for you to get elated and go, oh my God, it's this. Mm. And in some ways, I think it's more satisfying if they can get the audience to get it there than get it after. Yeah. If they can get it just before the reveal, that gives a thrill and the dopamine.
Yeah, makes the audience feel good.
Yeah, and I think they did that with this episode, if you knew who Sutek was in relation to Doctor Who. So what else was in there?
Time window.
Did you find that? I found the lead up to that a little slow. The whole going into the room, talking about the room, everyone to get behind the window, someone has to stay there. And there was just a lot of, like, preamble.
There was a lot of moving around where he said, don't move.
But when it actually actualizes and you see the past, from that point, I really enjoyed. It was just that little bit leading up to
that. A bit technical.
I mean, that was pretty much my only grumble for the episode. I thought the rest of it was very enjoyable.
Yeah, it was very good. I guess, so is Susan, is she another Harbinger?
I don't know. Yeah,
a herald
possibly.
Or something? Because that's what she seems like.
I do not know. I think that would be interesting. Maybe it should be something more. And there's Mrs. Flood from next.
Oh, yeah.
Lisa Dobson's character.
What about her?
Is she something else, or is she another red herring? I mean, Davis has said that within the episode, the positioning of Flood is there to distract, to get people who are, still, especially internet people, very much aware of her over what's going on elsewhere. I assume against trying to keep them distracted from looking too closely at Harriet. Though I did see today someone had noted, and I think, again, it's not a connection, but I think it might be another red herring, that the outfit that Mrs. Flood's wearing is an identical outfit to an outfit that Clara, from Matt Smith's Clara, she was wearing an identical outfit in her last story. And they were like, oh, is she Clara? And I'm just wondering whether this is just Davis now very aware of his audience.
Fucking around.
Exactly, and finding things to just kind of distract and miss.
Or just sharing the same wardrobe department.
Absolutely. I mean, someone else pointed out that there's an episode of Jodie Whittaker's Rosa where the bounty hunter in that had almost an identical outfit to what Njuti Gatwa was wearing in this story, the leather jacket and white shirt. which
I mean,
think
that is a look though.
Yeah, and it's just a costume. It's just reusing the wardrobe, as you say. But I do think it is interesting to think of, as a writer, how you engage with, kind of work with and work against your fan base, who is...
Subvert them. I guess Flood is kind of an ominous name.
We've had River Song, we've had Amy Pond. Again, I wonder whether that's a deliberate thing to get people off shooting. And as he said, yes, it's a way of engaging audiences and engaging attention in the show. You know, speculation keeps it in that cultural memory, the current cultural discourse rather than memory. But yes, I also thought that the TARDIS was very ominous as well. I thought that was another piece when they start looking at the TARDIS and suddenly that seems a really uncomfortable...
Making
its bad noises, yes.
So did going back to the time window allow it to come through?
I don't know. I think the narration at the end about the gods sort of suggests at the beginning that it attached itself to the TARDIS. I'm getting the feeling it's done it sometime in the past and it's been a part of the TARDIS for a while rather than in that time window.
Waiting,
because it talks about almost like the arrogant or foolish Time Lord or something, as if suggesting that it's been part of the TARDIS for a while and he's just not been aware of it. But again, we won't find out till next week, most likely.
So what do you reckon about Ruby's mother?
I don't know. I mean, a lot of people still think it's Ruby. I don't think it's going to be Ruby. I think that, again, he's obviously far too...
I think they can't pull that twice in one season.
Yeah, absolutely.
I think if it was going to be Ruby, then it wouldn't have been her as the
73
yards character.
Yeah. Plus, it's been done many times in time travel shows before. It's not in some way or another you...
Because if it is her, that still doesn't give you basically any satisfying answers as to why she is the way she is.
No, I don't know. I don't know what it's going to be. I'm not even 100% sure it's going to be anything, as a lot of fans hope, that it'll be something they already know. I think it could be something entirely different, or maybe something which moves on to the next series. I saw the speculation saying that they'd looked at the shoes that the person in the past wore and linked them to the shoes that Jodie Whittaker wore. Again, I think it's wardrobe recycling. It's not...
I think it might be a bit of a reach.
Yeah, but it's just, I think that is the level that everyone's at. And I think...
But it could be, because then that would make her, the biological child of the Doctor.
Well, people have speculated about that. Is this going to be a biological child of the Doctor? Especially since in that episode, there's that conversation where he says he's not had his kids yet that would bring his granddaughter, the Time Lord's...
Difficult.
So
get my head around.
So there could be an argument that this is what this is going to be, that this is a seed to create a daughter that would therefore become the mother of the eventual Susan granddaughter.
Mm.
But I still feel...
I want it to be something bad and scary.
Yeah, I have a horrible feeling when it was pointing at the TARDIS, that was suggesting that it isn't, that it might be something to a benefactor rather than an adversary. But yeah, I don't know. I think, as you said, if it was Ruby, I think it's just not that interesting. Ruby was her mother all along.
Doesn't make any sense.
No, I don't think it's going to go that route. But I don't really know where it's going to go. I think the problem is that as soon as you make such a mystery box, whatever's inside it is going to ultimately or potentially be disappointing. So we will see.
I want her to be the child of a god.
It would certainly make her... Next series, interesting. There was a report from one of the Wales newspapers confirming that she's not leaving after the series. A second companion's still coming in.
Who's going to be the second companion?
The female soldier in Boom is the actress. Whether it's going to be the same character, we don't know, but she is joining the team. So it seems like Millie's not being kicked, but it does sound like her star power has been a little diluted if the team is now moving to a 3 rather than a 2. So we will see on that. But yeah, so there are some interesting speculations. There has been some people pointing to an image, I think there might have been one of the trailers, that shows the Doctor and a TARDIS, which looks like a memory TARDIS, which is a new idea.
A memory TARDIS.
Well, they talk about, he does talk about memories and time. There is a very new thing that has been used as a spin-off since Russell T. Davis took over again, called, I think it's Tales of the TARDIS, which basically old stories of from the 20th century, bookended with little fictional pieces on board a memory TARDIS with the respective principal characters of that story. So it will open with a floating TARDIS, and inside it is a room of a hodgepodge of all the history of Doctor Who, full of eclectic
stuff. I see.
And the Seventh Doctor and Ace will appear. And
interesting.
Here, and then they'll talk, and then they'll realize they're there to tell a story from memory, and they'll recount one of their story, their episodes, so that they'll bookend. These are on iPlayer, so you can watch them on iPlayer. And I wonder, that idea of the memory TARDIS might actually be something relevant. Might be, might not be. But yeah, all bets are off. If you've not seen Pyramids of Mars, it is actually a very enjoyable 70s yarn, which is...
Is it Egyptians on Mars?
It's not. It's not.
Because Stargate kind of did that.
No, and to be fair, it's set on Earth. You'll be surprised to know in England, but it is essentially a god trapped on Mars.
Interesting.
And a battle to prevent him from being freed. That's the sort of storyline. It's on iPlayer. It's a good... It's a 90-minute one, four episodes. And I imagine most pigeons listening to this will have seen it and will already have glorified it, because it is actually a very enjoyable little romp.
A little romp against the god of death.
Yes, essentially. And robot mummies.
Ah. Interesting. When you see him on top of the TARDIS, he does have the look of Anubis.
I mean, there is an Anubis look in Pyramids of Mars, but it's not particularly successful. I think it's actually kind of freaky, but it's not quite to the animate level that we see in this story.
Better tech, better props.
So, yeah, so we're almost at the end of this series.
Went past so quickly. Yeah, they were good. I enjoyed, because they were so different, I enjoyed all of them for different reasons.
They are. They were very, very different. Cool. Well, so we will do the last one. We'll do
the finale.
The finale. We will catch you again. We will finish off with that, and we'll probably talk about how the whole thing held together. Right. We will see you next week, or week after.
Or will we?